Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, you're listening to New Books in History. I'm your host, Dexter Fergie, a PhD student at Northwestern University. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Margaret O'Meara, a professor of history at the University of Washington. We'll be discussing her stunning new book called The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. It was published just last month by Penguin Press. 70 years ago, Silicon Valley didn't exist. There was no Apple campus, no Googleplex, just sleepy towns, orange groves, and prune trees. Today, the valley, now called Silicon Valley, is a center of the global economy. Margaret O'Meara pulls readers along for a fast-paced narrative of how the valley became Silicon Valley and how it fundamentally transformed our world. The book narrates, among other aspects of the valley, the rise of the military-industrial complex, the origins of personal computing, and the continuing thread of gender politics that would eventually bring us the tech bro. The book will interest historians of technology, politics, and culture, along with anyone, professional or casual, who wants to know how Silicon Valley got to be so influential and important. I hope you enjoy our interview. I'm speaking with Margaret O'Meara about her new book, The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. It was an awesome book, and I'm really glad that we are getting a chance to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be here.
So just to get started, how did you become a historian interested in Silicon Valley?
Well, I think it's a two-part question. How did I become a historian? I actually came in a kind of unusual way. I spent 5 years working in Washington, D.C. in politics. I had the good timing or the dumb luck or who knows what to go to work in 1992 on a presidential campaign, the campaign of Bill Clinton and Al Gore, and they won. and so I ended up spending the first 5 years after college, working in Washington, D.C., working, among other things, in the West Wing of the White House and seeing power close up. And, I joke sometimes that I went to history grad school because I didn't want to go to law school like everyone else. I didn't want to become a lawyer. But it also was shaped by what I did when I was there. I, funnily enough, did not work on tech issues. I worked on economic policy. And I also worked on welfare reform, healthcare reform, and urban policy and urban investment reinvestment programs. And I had this lesson that one learns in first of all, Washington runs on young people, badly paid people who will work very, very hard. And so, as a relatively young person, I had a lot of exposure to. I was doing some pretty cool stuff, but you acquire this somewhat superficial expertise. You become an expert in the here and now. You become an expert on how certain programs work circa, the early to mid 90s when I was there. And I had very little sense of how we got to here. And I think the turning point for me was work on welfare reform, something that started off was a campaign promise of Clinton's as sort of a centerpiece of his becoming a new Democrat, a different sort of Democrat, a centrist Democrat. And in the first couple of years of the of the administration, a group of people, including me, worked very hard to craft welfare reform legislation that would change the system, but also in some way created something of an alternative safety net that was going to ensure that the realities of what were often young single mothers going to work, that they had the sort of support they needed, like childcare and transportation and all those things. And so while we were off in a corner being good, you know, diligent liberals trying to figure out how to thread the needle on welfare reform, then a political revolution happens in the form of the Gingrich revolution. The House and the Senate go from democratically controlled to Republican controlled, and Newt Gingrich and the new conservatives in the House had a very, very different idea of what social policy should look like and what welfare reform looked like. And it made me realize, well, one, that the painstaking business of legislation can't be kind of operating in a bubble that isn't recognizing broader political dynamics. And also that there were a lot of lessons from history that I didn't know and that I hoped, I wished that policymakers had been internalizing and understanding more as we were going forward. So that's really what motivated me to get in this business in the first place.
Hmm. And can you speak a bit more about how you became interested in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, so Silicon Valley, I again kind of came in through the side door, so to speak. I didn't enter graduate school thinking I was going to be a historian of technology. I thought I was going to be a historian of social policy. I was interested, again, coming in with having worked on these social policy programs. That's what I thought I was going to do. And I came to the topic because I was interested in writing a dissertation that focused on the 1950s. And part of this was the opportunistic grad student, you know, who's trying to figure out, oh, I'm going to write about something people aren't writing about. And at the time, there was a lot of work on the 60s, and there was not as much on the 50s in terms of domestic policy and social policy and economic development policy. And then as I got into that, I realized that the real story of the 50s, of course, was the Cold War and what the domestic economic effects of the Cold War were. And so then I kind of morphed into that. And then I realized, well, really, if we're thinking about the economic impact of the Cold War, the lasting one has been the creation of a new technology industry, an electronics and computing industry. And so that's how I got to Silicon Valley. A project that was my dissertation that became my first book, Cities of Knowledge, which was a comparative study of three places, Silicon Valley being one of them, the other two being Philadelphia and Atlanta, and trying to show that these were all, not only were these all places that were in the race to become electronics hubs or defense-oriented or scientific industry clusters, but also that, you know, there was an important role of space and geography in that. It was, you know, the question really answered by my first book is, why is high tech in the suburbs and what did the Cold War have to do with it? And mass suburbanization and Cold War, the military industrial complex happening simultaneously actually had a, you know, they were intertwined phenomena. And so it was, you know, how did we get to all these research parks? Which is funny because now you look at tech and you not only see research parks, but there's a lot of urban tech now. Mm-hmm. The geography of tech, particularly in the last 15 years, has changed quite dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really want to talk more about sort of the shifting geography of the tech industry. But before we get all the way there, I want you to kind of just set the scene for us. Let's say you're, you know, driving through the Santa Clara Valley in, let's say, the 1930s. You know, this is going to be the future home of Silicon Valley. What do you see?
Lots of fruit trees, lots of fruit orchards. You know, the Santa Clara Valley was very much like many other agricultural valleys in California. You know, originally Mexican ranchos created these very large, you know, these large land grants created these very large agribusiness enterprises. And it was mostly fruit growing. You would go down, but there were a couple of things that interrupted that landscape. One was, were military, the presence of the military, particularly the predecessor to NASA, NACA, had a facility in Sunnyvale that later becomes a NASA facility and an important part of this story that I tell in the book. And also Stanford University. which was founded in 1890 by a railroad baron and his wife on their former horse farm, which they deeded in toto to Stanford, about 8,000 acres of land. One of the provisions of the founding grant was that Stanford was never allowed to sell the land, which was kind of a bad economic bargain for the first 50 years of its existence, and then became an extraordinary wealth creator for Stanford in the post-World War II period, as the peninsula suburbanized and as electronics industries started moving to the area.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, it's really almost incomprehensible just how much change the Valley undertook in the decades that you write about in your book. But it's especially hard to imagine the Valley just filled with prune trees and orange groves.
I actually early on did a search. Thank God for OCR and these newspaper databases. And I decided to do a search of mentions of San Jose or the Santa Clara Valley in national, meaning East Coast based newspapers in the 1920s, just for fun. And the only thing I could find was mentions of Prune Week, which were the kind of the San Jose Chamber of Commerce boosters did this annual Prune Week every February, whose motto was "Eat a prune a day, keep the doctor away." So that was what, when you thought Santa Clara Valley, if you thought about it at all, you thought about prunes. and yes, there were some, but there were sparks, there were signs, like any, the presence of a university meant that there were clusters of, there were people in workshops around Palo Alto who were, tinkering around with radio equipment. And in a way, this was a very common thing in the early decades of the 20th century. You had these little clusters of ferociously industrious people who were inventing things. But it wasn't just in California. It was in, places like Dayton, Ohio, where the Wright brothers and NCR were. It was, you name your city, you found inventors. There was extraordinarily, Americans were very prolific, particularly in the late 19th century and early 20th century, in terms of young American men tinkering with things and filing patents and trying to start companies. This kind of startup instinct is not an entirely modern invention.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to imagine Silicon Valley today, like it's sort of like in the popular imagination, an imagination that's not yet informed by your book, we might think of things like, free markets, entrepreneurs, self-made billionaires. What do the origins of Silicon Valley say about that image?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that turns the fruit trees into transistors effectively is World War II and the Cold War and the government's decision to do something it's never done before, which is get into, I'm talking about the federal government, get into the sponsorship of research and development, science and technology in a big way, in a significant way. And this kind of becomes what Stanford's Dean of Engineering and later Provost Fred Terman, who's an important character in the early part of this book, what he terms a wonderful opportunity for a place like Stanford, which was sort of, had a decent reputation, but was not top ranked yet, to really remake itself and become the perfect Cold War university.
Mm. Can you say a bit more about that? What is this relationship with the federal contracts and the war?
So there's this tsunami of military spending that washes over the country, but particularly over the Pacific Coast. So you have up and down the Pacific Coast. You have aerospace in Seattle. You have also have aerospace industry in LA. In the Bay Area, you have all sorts of different defense-related activity that is taking place, affiliated with Berkeley as well as Stanford. But in the San Francisco Peninsula around Stanford, around Sunnyvale, this specialization very quickly becomes small electronics and communications devices, microwave, radar, transistorized technology. Very cutting edge, but different than building airplanes. But this tsunami of spending, think about this. This is the late 40s and early 50s. This is the era of, this is McCarthyism. This is a time when, the reason that all this spending is happening in the first place is as part of the competition with the Soviets, not only to build more powerful weapons, but also to produce more scientists and to, you know, send men into space and to orbit faster than the Soviets and to prove this scientific supremacy. But if the whole point is to compete with and distinguish the American system from the Soviet system, the last thing that lawmakers like Dwight Eisenhower have any inclination to do is create these giant government research labs that internalize everything. And so really this giant, instead, the giant research lab becomes decentralized into, and the money flows through in good part, these other institutions, public and private universities, private industry, indirectly, creating this whole parastatal network of entities that are vastly enriched by and transformed by Cold War spending, but also, you know, turning it into something of a hidden presence. And the other thing about this indirect flow of spending, where instead of building a digital computer inside an Army laboratory, the Army instead gives money to, in the case of the first all-digital computer, the University of Pennsylvania in the 1940s, to develop something there. And relatively speaking, this can, you know, continues to the 50s and 60s and on, it's a lot of money flowing in the direction of this industry and these disciplines with not a lot of strings attached, with a lot of room for invention and creation and iteration. There's a lot of investment in basic research, not just applied research. There's a lot of investment in the R as opposed to the R of research as opposed to the D of development, although there's a lot of investment in that too. There's a lot of investment in education, K through 12 education, as well as higher education, particularly in the sciences and mathematics and engineering. So there's a great deal. What I describe in the book is this Cold War public sector foundation that creates a perfect platform on which entrepreneurial activity can grow and flourish, and really building an industry in a way that makes the people who are leading that industry feel like they're doing it all on their own. And that's really the secret. That's one reason that other places around the world have had such a hard time. You know, they've wanted to build silicon somethings, and oftentimes the, you know, the lawmaker or leader will say, we are going to build a science city and put it here. Well, you know, Dwight Eisenhower never proclaimed we shall build a science city in the San Francisco Bay Area, but yet one happened. And so there's this, it's a story of unintended consequences, but it is a story in which government long-range investments and the sorts of investments that were being made in this golden quarter century after World War II, a quarter century in which, by the way, there was not, you know, most of the meaningful industrial competition was in rubble after World War II. So it was very easy. It's easy to be generous when you're both on the corporate side and on the governmental side, when there isn't as much competition and balance sheets are feeling flush. So this particular, you know, what I wanted to root this in this book, kind of the reason I start in the 40s, I go all the way to now. But this is a trade book. It's not only designed to engage an academic conversation and make Silicon Valley, you know, I would like my fellow historians to really put Silicon Valley into the center of this broader narrative of modern American history. So what I strove to do was show these interconnections between, you know, the political history we write and the social history we write and teach, and show how Silicon Valley is both a product of that and shaping that. But I also wanted to show an audience of tech users and the tech curious and a business audience, including people inside tech today, to understand how we got to right now, how the software eating the world is the product of seven decades of history, and to understand the business culture and also to understand the continuing engagement between the public sector, between Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley, the tech industry writ large. We have to recognize that there's a longer political history here.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's something that you're book does just remarkably well is showing this relationship between, you know, the state and the private sector. And, you know, it's not just that they're, you know, interacting or they're, you know, depending on one another, but that like the way that the federal money was dispersed with very few strings attached actually produced the mindset of Silicon Valley as this like entrepreneurial, you know, like a free market place.
Yeah. And I should add, you know, that entrepreneurial, you know, brilliance is very much part of the book and part of the story. And this is also, I think, a cautionary, you know, I think we too, those of us who study the history of American politics and the American state sometimes can put the state back in. And we never want to, no pun intended, overstate the case, right? That part of really understanding the political economy, particularly the political economy of modern America and post-industrial America, is to recognize this interplay between public and private. And what I do also show in the book, it's funny, I went into the project thinking, well, everyone's written so much about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, and I don't need to talk about them. I'm going to talk about other people who aren't them, which I do in the book. I really try to introduce characters and types of people that illustrate that this is a community effort, a team effort. It took a village to build all these companies, more than a village. And there are a lot of other people who are an important part of the story that sometimes get overlooked. But also there's a reason that so much ink has been spilled in analyzing and trying to understand people like Jobs and Gates and Bezos and Zuckerberg, because there are things about them that enabled their companies to break from the pack and to become market dominant. So really recognizing this, you know, how do we, and I think this is a challenge, sort of a broader historiographic challenge, particularly for those of us who write about the state and public policy, is to think about how we put the people in, how we put the personalities in and the human stories in, including the human stories of, you know, presidents and lawmakers who are just as fallible and interesting and textured as all the rest of us. And also show how the top down meets the bottom up in a way that is creating a compelling narrative and recognizing that all of these institutions, whether it be a big corporation or a small startup or a university or a government agency, they aren't just institutional monoliths. They are not just acronyms. They're filled with people. They have certain leadership, and then they also have people in the rank and file and the other, you know, lesser known aspects of their leadership that make them what they are. And so that was something that I tried to be very mindful of in the book. And again, to understand Silicon Valley, you cannot say it's all or nothing. It is not all a big government Cold War story. And by the way, the government story doesn't go away after the Cold War. It, you know, goes on in many different ways, you know, uninterrupted fashion until the present day. Not only the defense economy, the Pentagon never goes away from Silicon Valley story. DARPA is extraordinarily important to this day. But also you have lobbying, you have interplay between elected officials of both parties and technology executives and venture capitalists that is a hallmark of the last 40 plus years of the Valley's history.
Mm-hmm. So you've already kind of gestured towards some of the answers to this question that I'm going to ask, but I was hoping that you could maybe say a bit more. So you were playing two games with this book. You know, you're playing an academic game. You're writing for an academic audience. And, you know, tons of your readers are going to be, you know, historians and mm-hmm. political scientists and so on. But then you also are writing for the public. This is a very hard, it's very hard to play these two games simultaneously. What were some of the challenges that you faced and perhaps what have been the payoffs?
Yeah, it's been really challenging. I'll be honest, this is my third book. It's by far the hardest one I ever had to write. Because I was trying to do both things. And really, you know, my foremost, I thought the trade market, the broader market needed a biography of Silicon Valley that was accessible, that was written, that a non-technologist could understand. And that was also neither you know, unreservedly cheerleading nor tearing things down. And just simply telling the history, try as fairly as one possibly could. But it was challenging. I think my answer to that, and I think it's something that I will take forward in all of my writing, even when I am writing, you know, for purely academic audiences, is to, you know, lead with the people rather than leading with the argument. There's a very important role for work that leads with an argument. But what I have discovered is through the book was that how I could advance an argument by leading with the stories of individuals and how they could be my, you know, they could carry my story forward. And now that I've kind of built up that muscle, I don't want to let it wither. But it also is a way too, I think, for, you know, engaging. I wanted, you know, this is designed to engage a wide range of readers who are coming at it from different levels of expertise. And I also am also wanting to make a case to my fellow academics of the importance of this story. You know, this will be just as the textbooks have the large section on Rockefeller and Carnegie and et al. And the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. You know, the textbooks of 50 and 100 years from now will have a similar, I would imagine, give similar weight to the stories of Bezos and Zuckerberg and the phenomena of the technology industry. And so, you know, how, and also it's getting, it's old enough now that enough dust has settled that you can bring our tools of historical analysis to the topic in a way that might not have been possible only recently. You know, we are now getting into the history of the 21st century, believe it or not. And, but this isn't just a 21st century history. This is a 20th century history. This is a, you know, post 1945 history, but really I could have started the book in the 19 teens had I wanted to. That was another, I think probably ultimately the biggest challenge in the book was deciding what to put in and what to leave out, because it's an extremely big story. And I didn't want to end up with a, you know, 1,000-page behemoth that no one would read and, quite frankly, and no one would publish for that matter. And so I really, you know, not everything is in. There are still, as of many stories there are here, there are ones that have yet to be written. There are ones where I was able to, you know, devote a page and a half to something that really has fodder for at least 20 dissertations. So I hope, if anything, my book will also be a good kind of trail of breadcrumbs for the next generation of scholars who are starting to look at Silicon Valley and the technology industry with the same sort of lens, who are coming at it from the lenses of labor history and social history and history of capitalism and political history, as well as the continuing important work in the history of science and technology. I mean, incredibly important work has been produced recently and over the past decades. And I, you know, at the end of my book, I have a very long section on sources that is designed in part for the general interest reader who wants to learn more and learn more from all of the work that I have learned from.
Yeah, there were several moments in the book where I thought this could be spun off into like another book at least.
Yeah.
But it's just such a big story.
It's a really big story. It's a really big story. And it's a fun, I mean, there's fun stuff too. Like there are, you know, stories that I uncovered that were, you know, just made me giddy.
Yeah.
And connections. There's sort of this wonderful, one of the hallmarks of the Valley and the part of what makes it go and also part of what makes create some of its problems for itself is it's so tightly networked and everyone's connected. I would have, you know, I was interviewing these 90-something-year-old venture capitalists, and they would, you know, they're all living in the same retirement community and all have lunch together every other Tuesday. So I could just sit in the, you know, have a club sandwich with them and talk about the 50s and 60s. And they've been having lunch together, you know, for 60 years. They're all friends.
Yeah, that's so fascinating.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. I mean, you ended up doing several oral history interviews. I think like 2.5 dozen or something like that.
I did a lot.
But I guess if they're all living together, it's not as arduous as the bibliography would suggest. Yeah. So that's actually a great lead to another question that I wanted to ask, which is about the geography of Silicon Valley. Why does it matter that Silicon Valley is geographically so far from Washington and New York?
I think it mattered tremendously. I'd call it in the book an entrepreneurial Galapagos, where isolation encouraged the creation of very distinctive species of business enterprise and business services. So it's not just the distinctiveness of the high-tech startup Silicon Valley style, but it also is high-tech venture capital. There's venture capitalists all over, and I talk quite a bit about non-Valley-based venture capitalists in the book. But those who were in Silicon Valley, many of them were former their engineers. They were in the industry before, and they had a hit, and they turned to venture capital. We still see this happening now. You know, the people who are made rich by the previous generation get to pick the winners of the next. And they were, by and large, pretty. The first generation were men of modest means. Their great advantage was being educated white men in post-war America. there's a reason there weren't a lot of women venture capitalists at the outset. But they were coming from, you know, middle-class families in the middle part of the country. One of the reasons they ended up in California was because they didn't have connections. They weren't Ivy Leaguers who'd gone to prep school and could go to their friend's father's bank or go into some Fortune 50 company. They were coming out to create lives for themselves and create a professional future for themselves. And then there were also some who might have had those connections and decided, sort of personality-wise, that was too boring for them, so they came out. So you have this mix of people who are geographically isolated. They're also isolated from San Francisco. It's 40 miles south of San Francisco. Then and now, it's still an hour on the train. I took the Caltrain yesterday. It hasn't sped up anytime soon.
Gosh. And
it was, you know, you were had this in a way kind of forced to spend all of your time together. So people worked tremendously hard, work hard, play hard. And then they would go to one of the two bars that were around afterwards and drink together and socialize with their families, and their kids would play Little League together, and they all lived in the same neighborhoods. And, you know, so there are these really tight personal and professional connections that develop, and these venture capital firms, law firms, and real estate developers that are completely oriented towards the electronics / technology industry. Real estate development is part of the story. Talk about geography. I talked about those ranchos earlier. It was made it very, very easy to redevelop large swaths of land in a pretty frictionless way, as they say now in Silicon Valley. So you have these fruit farmers who have these orchards. A real estate developer would drive up and say, I'm going to offer you X dollars for your land. X is, you know, two times more than you could ever get for it on the agricultural market. And you say, I'm in, and you sell it. And all of a sudden there are hundreds of acres that can be plowed over, plowed under, and you can build up, tilt up, you know, quick and easy office parks with, you know, in a, just like that. And so that ease of, you know, creation of an industrial landscape was something that was quite different than, say, Boston, which was the other tech capital up until, you know, the 80s, was really not only Silicon Valley's first its big brother, and then its equal, and then, you know, it was quite late in the game when Boston kind of became secondary to the story.
Just as a quick aside, I actually interviewed Lily Geismer about her book, wrote 128, and it was just a completely different story, even though it's about the same world, so to speak.
Yeah. The business culture is different. The people are different. The driving force is different. The defense industry is extremely important there too, but there's much more acknowledgement that that's central. and also there's, you know, Boston was computing when Silicon Valley was not. And it was the capital of mini computing, which was the, you know, shining star of the industry from the late 60s into the 80s, but then it didn't have a second act. And what's so remarkable about the Valley, and part of this is just lucky, you know, I talked about the specialization in small electronics and communications devices. Turns out that those are the things that are the ingredients of the digital revolution to come. It isn't building big refrigerator sized computers. It's networking those computers and making those computers small. And so what does the Valley do? It's, you know, it has these successive technological generations that at first glance seem like they're unconnected, and you don't understand, like, how does today's Facebook connect to Shockley Semiconductor? But it does. It does technologically as well as in the people. Technologically, you have the silicon transistor. First of all, the Valley makes the bet on silicon as the material for the transistor, as opposed to germanium, which was the other, you know, prevalent material. Turns out silicon's a heck of a lot better to build microchips with. So that gives way to integrated circuit. So more transistors, a more powerful chip. And then that gives way to an even more powerful microprocessor, which was tagged as a computer on a chip. And once you have a computer on a chip, then you can essentially put it in a box and create a personal computer. Not very high powered, but enough to do what it needed to do. And then there comes the personal computer industry. Then you have the higher powered versions of those, the workstations, Sun Microsystems et al. And then Silicon Graphics, another defunct company. And then you have the web, which is connecting all those computers, wiring them together, and then creating a whole commercial enterprise, this whole series of platforms, communications platforms. So there's sort of the success of technologies, and they have technological connective tissue, and they have connective tissue in the venture capitalists who fund them, who are, again, the winners of the one generation fund the winners of the next. And they're not just providing money, they're providing mentorship, they're providing business organization. Why did Apple break out of the pack from all these little personal computer companies that are growing here in the late 70s? Which were, you know, a bunch of garage operations. It's because they got some smart business management early on from a guy named Mike Markla, who was an Intel executive, who was deciding whether to take early retirement. And he was like 36, and instead he put some of his own money into Apple and came in and helped them run the joint. And they got some early venture capital funding from guys like Don Valentine and Arthur Rock, who were, you know, veterans of the semiconductor industry, and then they had Steve Jobs, the ultimate evangelist, as well as the technical genius of Steve Wozniak. So that was, you know, put that formula together, and that pumps, you know, pushes it forward. And the countercultural company of Apple, that kind of what, you know, always presented itself as a think different sort of place. Actually, part of its secret was that it kind of adapted good strategies of basic corporate business organization earlier than some of the other guys in garages. And so that put them ahead of the pack.
Yeah. So the computer, it's going to be central to your story. Mm-hmm. And Apple's right there. You take your readers into sort of like these like intimate spaces of, you know, like kind of like early computing hacker communities. You know, like one is the Homebrew Club.
Mm-hmm.
And you have these just really lovely sources, you know, like the invitation to the first meeting that the Homebrew Computer Club held. And, you know, it reads, are you building your own computer? Terminal, TV, typewriter, device, or some other digital black magic box? Or are you buying time on a time-sharing service? If so, you might like to come to a gathering of people with like-minded interests, exchange information, swap ideas, talk shop, help work on a project, whatever. And these sources just like they just give such a really nice texture to the world that you're describing. And one of the things that's really interesting, and again, you've already alluded to it, is how they go from this countercultural world or milieu to this like more corporate, orientation. How did these two different cultures work? How do we end up with kind of the later Apple that kind of combines them?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because this is the Vietnam generation, the 60s generation, baby boomers, who are the ones who are the on the ground floor of the personal computer industry, and which starts off as just a hobby, guys who are tinkering in their garages. And these are people who are, many of them, in college in the late 60s at Berkeley, at Stanford. They are involved in, or at least sympathetic to, the anti-war movement and affected by it. They definitely they see what they're doing as political, but it's very interesting and it's different. It shouldn't be just, you know, kind of, oh, they were countercultural or they were new left. They weren't new left. They were, you know, they were sympathetic to the goals of the new left. But they saw the answer to the dilemmas raised by feminists, by the Black Power movement, these questions of inequity, of big government and big business having too much control. They saw computing and seizing computing power and making it personal. They saw that as the answer. It was a very techno-optimistic vision, and it's one that becomes the hallmark of Silicon Valley going forward. That if we have the right tech, we can fix it. There's an app for that. And the funny thing is this generation, the homebrew generation, for lack of a better shorthand, is, you know, they are into computing in the first place because they went to these universities. They grew up in the age of the Cold War and the military-industrial complex, and at a time when the federal government is putting so much money into science and math education. And so they are, you know, winning science fair ribbons in the late 50s and early 60s. They're dreaming of going to the moon. They want to be astronauts. They come to college and they become, you know, they major in engineering or they major in a whole host of things. But they go to the computer lab and they get their first experience and interface with a computer. Computers that only you could find at universities or in big, large corporations. And they realize that there's incredible power here. They're very excited by the potential of the computer, but they also were angry that the computers are all in the possession of the man, so to speak. That, you know, and it's true. Where was computing in the late 60s? It was, you know, they were mainframes and minis that were humming in government agencies, in academic laboratories funded by government, in defense contractors, in Fortune 50 companies. The ultimate gatekeepers were controlling that information. There was similar kind of agony and questioning about, you know, how much information does the computer know, and the worry about individuals' privacy being violated by electronic data processing. And so the personal computing movement is motivated by, you know, wanting to take those, you know, as one of the characters in my book says, you know, to change the rules, change the tools. If you really want to change society, you need to change the technologies we're using and turn them into technologies of empowerment and communication rather than disempowerment and opacity and secrets.
Mm-hmm. Another sort of through line in your book, it relates to gender politics and sort of you pay a lot of attention to sort of the gender makeup and the racial makeup, for that matter, of these, Silicon Valley types. It's really fascinating because you can see all the contemporary, scandals, with just sort of like the tech bro stereotype, the lack of women and so on. You can see how this was baked into the Silicon Valley system from the start. And one sort of bit of evidence that you keep on coming back to, and I was really interested in, and I'm hoping that you can maybe say a bit more about it, mm-hmm. was hiring practices. These startups and Silicon Valley companies have particular hiring practices that almost enforce at least generate homogeneity in their workforce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it takes slightly different forms over the whole time period, but it's always there. And really the center of it is hiring who you know, hiring by referral or something, mm-hmm. someone who's somewhat of a known quantity. We see this now very frequently. In fact, companies today will sort of trumpet this and encourage their employees to say, who do you know? Tell us who you know. We're recruiting more engineers. We're recruiting more people. We want to hear from you. And so employee referrals make up a really significant portion of the new hires in tech companies today. And this has been the case going all the way back. I talk about, we have companies like Salesforce and Google that do it. In the dot-com era, you have companies like Netscape that are doing it and, you name it. Go back earlier and this is a product too of the relatively small size of the community, the geographic concentration of the community, like people do know one another. But it is also how people form teams and new startups. It's like, it's a risky business. You're making bets on people who aren't coming in with particular business expertise or management expertise. They're often very young. They're being hired on the basis of their smarts or perceived smarts, their ability to, their technical ability. And also, are they going to be someone who's a good person to work with? Are they going to deliver? Are they going to be someone who's going to be a team player? And the way that you assess that often is, oh, well, I know this person from graduate school, or I worked with this person for my last company. And so, legendary venture capitalist Arthur Rock talked often about you want to pick a grade A man. And of course, they were almost always men then and continue to be. You're making the choice of you're choosing the person as well as the idea that they're pitching. This permeates. And again, this is part of the secret. This is part of the secret sauce, the magic. That you don't see in other places. It has been integral to the Valley's success. Its ability. And look, if you're starting a risky startup, you do want to have some assurance that the person is not going to be, flame out. You do want to have some other reference points to know that, okay, there's going to be some personal obligation here, or there's going to be, I'm going to get along with this person if I'm spending 24 hours coding with them. There's an intimacy, especially in these young, small startup companies that, where personal compatibility makes a difference and where culture, quote unquote, culture has become paramount. But then that coupled with this conviction that so many people in the industry have had that it's a meritocracy, that all we care about is if someone's a good programmer, if they're a good technical person, causes you to overlook, not only to overlook the biases you might have about what you think a good programmer is or a good technical person is. And I have many examples in the book and many times I encountered in my research women who were, told and men who just really felt that, well, women can't be technical people. Like that's not, they may have other talents, but you can't have a woman building your operating system. You can't have a woman, doing these critical technical roles because that's not their aptitude. And that's, as we know, is, not something that's still kicking around today. And so when you have those biases and those presumptions. And also you're not looking very widely for where your talent's going to come from. If you're always looking to Stanford's computer science program or a small handful of computer science programs, or you're always just focusing first on the people who are known to the people who are already working in the company, then it replicates, your circle doesn't widen. And you also might not be identifying talent of, you know, people who aren't able to be in these very privileged spaces that might not have gotten into one of those elite programs, couldn't afford to. And you're also not bringing people into the room who are asking different questions, who are bringing different product ideas, and maybe answering product problems differently, saying, hey, you know what, maybe we should, you know, make sure that this, this biometric device also monitors women's health and not just men's. You know, or let's think about how our social media product might play in Pakistan, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to just in Northern California. So these are all things that are actually kind of critical to the business, especially now the tech is so predominant. It's so critical to, you know, being smart and making sure that you're, you know, reaching global markets. There's a bottom line upside here. But the history, you know, I think helps us understand why there are such persistent diversity problems, why they're hard to unwind. I think the open conversation that has been going on over the last few years in the Valley around diversity is promising simply because it is a conversation that has never happened before, ever. And if anything, people are talking about it, and that's the first step to changing things.
Sure. And yeah, and I really encourage the listeners of this podcast to have a look at the book. I mean, just you end up telling the stories of so many women who were they were there in like the 70s in the you know, the homebrew club. They were there in the 90s working for Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And you gracefully tell their stories. So moving on just a little bit into the 90s, I want to talk about the internet. So, you know, in the early 1990s, the U.S. government, and I guess you were there, as, you know, a recently graded researcher.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. government begins to ponder how to regulate the internet. And so, you know, Congress was leaning towards a pretty, you know, strict censorship regime. The Democrats, you know, they wanted to be seen as, you know, very pro-tech. You have the Atari Democrats. And then you have this other guy, Newt Gingrich, who becomes one of the biggest allies of many in Silicon Valley, who wants to see almost no regulation, or at least the regulation to happen at the level of the corporation rather than the government. Can you just say a little bit about these regulatory debates and how they shape the development of the internet?
Yeah, well, they're incredibly important. I mean, what happens in the 1990s is, you know, two things. One is that the government is laying down the infrastructure, what was then called the information superhighway, that allowed the commercial internet to grow and to scale. First, it allowed the internet to become a commercial platform in the first place for a very long time. You know, internet was around since 1969, of course, but it was restricted to academics who were, you know, federally funded academics on grants and people who were inside government agencies until the late 80s. And then it opens up to commercial, to people who wanted to create .com domains, but they couldn't do any business on the internet. They could create a website, but they couldn't actually, you know, you couldn't buy or sell. You couldn't make money on the internet. And so in 1991, that changes and that opens up. So there are choices to, you know, open up the internet. There are also choices to invest in infrastructure, in the actual telecommunications infrastructure that allows the plumbing of the internet to happen, and to encourage private industry and telecoms to, you know, create a way to, for, you know, so not everyone's, remember dial-up, you know, you'd have dial-up internet, yep. You'd hear the noise, you know, that there's that is, you know, thank you lawmakers in the 1990s. We moved beyond that. At the same time, there is a, you know, by the middle part of the 1990s, there are enough people going online. And of course, what was one of the, you know, the biggest initial growth industry online? It was porn. And so smut online, porn online is really the catalyst for this conversation in Washington. This is 1995, 1996. This is after the Republicans are control of Capitol Hill, Democrats are in the White House. You know, what are we going to do about online porn? And this is, you know, and the big question is, what about the children who are going to be exposed to this horrible stuff? So we need to censor it. We need to find a way to get this stuff. You know, there's other ways to censor it in other media. Why is this just, why is it a free for all on the internet? This is terrible. And the Valley pushes back on that, pushes back saying, you know what, if you start, if Washington writes rules on what can be said and not said on the internet, then that is going to quash free speech on the internet. It's going to quash, you know, what's building here, what the miracle of the internet. And these are, you know, Valley people who are internet evangelists. They're people like John Perry Barlow and Mitch Kapor and people, the founders of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, which continues to be a very important player in these conversations. And they're like, you're going to squash the, you know, this lively conversation and this, and the capacity of the internet to become a communications medium that is going to empower people and connect them and remove gatekeepers and allow all sorts of new collaboration and creativity. It's a very, you know, techno-optimistic Silicon Valley vision in action. And it's one to which Newt Gingrich, then Speaker of the House, and Democrats, including notably Al Gore, who was then vice president, were very sympathetic to, in part because, you know, props to Gingrich and Gore and a few others like Ed Markey is another one I call out in the book. They are really the handful of lawmakers on Capitol Hill in the 80s and the early 90s who are paying attention to any of this stuff. They're bringing computer scientists into their offices and asking them about it. Markey, who's chairing the telecom subcommittee in the House in this pivotal moment when the internet is being commercialized, is also thinking about things like, you know, high definition television and kind of next gen technologies that are going to, you know, really enable the things that we do now online, and really transform the whole media environment. But, you know, Washington lawmakers have, you know, then and now don't have a terribly good track record of being super technologically savvy. And so there was a bit of, you know, moral panic about porn on the internet in the mid 90s. But what comes out of this, the Valley free speech advocates, they win. They in part because, as you pointed out, Newt Gingrich was not a big fan of regulating anything. And what the Valley argues, and also the Clinton administration agrees with their argument, it's like, don't regulate us, let us regulate ourselves. Like, just let us take care of ourselves. We'll make sure that we don't let, you know, all this junk run wild on the internet. We'll create some rules. We're in business. We don't want to alienate whole chunks of our potential audience. But let us regulate ourselves. Don't let don't regulate us. And also, if you regulate us, you're going to let the big media companies and telecoms win, because they're the ones who control the plumbing. They're controlling what gets said. It's going to give too much power to these cable providers and these other industries. Now, that was 1996, right? It was a very different internet then. Google didn't exist. Facebook, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg was in middle school. Amazon had its website live for less than a year. There's just a very different, it's just a very different world. And it's, it, you know, and it was the right, in many ways, the decision to self-regulate was, you know, made sense at the time. And there's a lot of sensibility in it. Would we have had the growth of social media without that ability to, you know, for these platforms to be held harmless for what third parties said and did on their platforms? Probably not. So for all, even though right now everyone's piling on companies like Facebook, for good reason, we're also, you know, there's a sort of baby with the bathwater danger as well, and not recognizing some of the things that have been produced, not just economically, but also in terms of the sort of, I mean, here we are right now having this conversation that's enabled by these choices made in the 1990s, you know, to have like all these new media outlets, all these new podcasts, all these new content producers, all these conversations that were previously just being had in academic seminar rooms are now free and open for anyone to listen to around the world. And that's, you know, so how do we, I think that's the, you know, I'm not here to make policy prescriptions. I worked in policy a long time ago, but that was a long time ago. And I consciously switched hats. But I think where historians can be really, really valuable is in pointing out, okay, here's how we got here, and understand the history and understand the rationale for why, you know, certain laws were passed, for example, and recognize that updating is a healthy and necessary thing.
Great. Well, I think that's a wonderful place to leave the conversation about your book. But just one final question. Mm-hmm. What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm thinking a lot about, I've always, you know, whatever I write in the future will have to do with the things, I think the common thread that goes through that what I've written about before is looking at how powerful people are shaped by their times. You know, I've written about presidents and presidential elections, and I've written about Silicon Valley. And I continue to be really interested in that broader project, and also in, I like disrupting some myths and busting some myths. So I won't say what the next big project will be, but I will say it will be something about that. In the meantime, I'm doing a couple things that play into why I got into the history business in the first place. I got my PhD in history because I wanted to speak to public audiences. Funnily enough, I came into graduate school not thinking I was going to be a professor. I thought I was going to go back and work in public policy in some way or work in a think tank. And you know, life changes, right? It's funny. A lot of people go to graduate school thinking they're going to be an academic, and then life changes and they end up being doing something else. I was the reverse. Nonetheless, I think this sort of public engagement is a very important part of what our profession does. And those of us who have the energy and the interest in doing that should do it. So I've got a couple of things on the burner. One is continuing to write op-eds and public writing that reaches broader audiences, that distills historiography, both my historiography and the broader historiography of American history to broader audiences. And the other thing that I'm working on is I'm joining a longstanding textbook project, The American Pageant. I'm joining Liz Cohen and David Kennedy as an author on that in forthcoming editions. So, I think that textbooks are a really critical part of our whole enterprise in terms of reaching a vast number of people, and perhaps being their first and perhaps their only encounter with certain elements of parts of American history. So being able to write that succinctly and carefully and with resonance and relevance is a daunting task, but a really important one.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I think the textbooks are a form of public history because you do reach a very sizable audience. So I'll be looking forward to seeing those projects. And I'm also very intrigued by the mysterious myth-busting one, but we'll have to wait and find out what that is. Margaret, I really want to thank you for joining me today.
It was really a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the New Books in History podcast.